Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with the front page article from the Wednesday, April 10th edition, headlined Back to Back. With a second NCAA championship in a row, the Huskies cement themselves as one of the best teams in college basketball history. This coverage is by David Borges and Paul Doyle. UConn versus Purdue was billed as the clash of the giants between Donovan Clingan and Zach Edey. But as UConn proved time and time again this season, their team is so much more than that. The well-rounded Huskies had the perfect game plan. They executed, and they showed last year's run wasn't a fluke. UConn is back and has now claimed 6 national championships in the last 26 years. 1999, 2004, 2011, 2014, 2023, and 2024. The UConn men's basketball team surpassed some of the great programs in the history of both the sport and the Huskies' own illustrious outfit, winning its second straight national championship on Monday night at State Farm Stadium in front of 74,423 fans, about 50,000 or so pulling for Purdue. The Huskies' overall depth trumped Purdue's one-man Zach attack in a 75-60 victory over the Boilermakers. Zach Edey had 37 points and may have won his 7-foot showdown with Donovan Clingan, but UConn's depth won out with yet another double-digit win, the Huskies' 12th straight in NCAA tournament play. UConn becomes the first men's program to repeat as national champions since Florida in 2006 and 2007. It's the Huskies' 6th national title, vaulting them past Kansas and Indiana, and tied for 3rd overall with North Carolina. Only UCLA, with 11, and Kentucky, with 8, have won more. And no, Hurley won't be heading to Kentucky to try to win number 9. UConn's 68 wins over the past 2 seasons are the most in a 2-year span in program history. The Huskies finish 4-0 this season against the Big Ten, 3 of them in the NCAA tournament, Northwestern, Illinois, and Purdue. They are 19-1 over the past 2 seasons against Power 5 foes, all with 19 wins by double digits. The celebration was still unfolding at State Farm Stadium when Tristan Newton bounced off the elevated court and found his parents. He worked his way down the line hugging friends and family, a group that included cousins Aaron and Alvin Jones. The Jones brothers, both NFL players, were among the most vocal and boisterous fans in the football stadium. When Newton returned to the court, the cell phones recorded his every move. There was laughter and tears and hugs among the family from El Paso. Tristan Newton was a 0 star in high school as a recruit 5 years ago. He drew little interest and landed at East Carolina, where he played for 3 years before transferring to UConn. As he leaves Connecticut in 2024, Newton is among the greats to wear a UConn uniform. Sound excessive? Consider that he was an important player on 2-time national champions, an All-American this season, and on Monday night was named the most outstanding player in the Final Four. "Coming here meant a lot," Newton said. "Obviously, it changed my life. To see what I've done since I went here and what I've been able to accomplish to win 2 national championships back-to-back, it's unheard of. And we had a whole different team." Also on today's front page, officials push for cleaner school air. This front page article by Ken Dixon. The pandemic may be in the rearview mirror for some residents, but unhealthy air still lingers in many Connecticut schools. Advocates, educators, and state lawmakers said on Tuesday, marking National Healthy Schools Day. There is a need for a sustained commitment to the pandemic-era improvements in public school air quality, the group said during a press conference in the Legislative Office Building, particularly with the inevitable end of federal funding for upgrades to heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems in both suburban and urban districts. They called for a 10-year extension of the General Assembly's School Indoor Air Quality Working Group, including HVAC professionals and state agencies in studying and overseeing the issue that's contained in pending legislation. The General Assembly adjourns this budget adjustment short session year at midnight on May 8th. Some people say, well, isn't this already the law? Isn't it already the responsibility of state government to ensure that we have healthy schools? That said Senator Julie Kushner of Danbury, who co-chaired the working group, which is seeking an extension to 2030. She and State Representative Jennifer Leeper of Fairfield, the other co-chairwoman, said that the panel has been allowed to focus on solutions. They said that to put the pandemic into the past and prepare for the future, it's even more important to continue to upgrade school air quality with testing and new equipment. This isn't over yet, Kushner said during a half-hour news conference. I think most people know that it's really expensive to upgrade these systems and to replace these systems, and the need is really going to be there long-term. We know the best investment we can make in this state is in our children. We know clean air helps them to learn better. About 100 out of Connecticut's 1,500 school buildings have had HVAC upgrades over the last 2 years at a cost of about $53 million. Advocates expect more than 100 schools to be included in the next round of grants, expected to soon be announced by the State Department of Administrative Services. Meanwhile, annual building reviews and 5-year comprehensive inspections have created baseline information on so-called sick schools. Louis Rosado Birch, a legislative coordinator for the Connecticut Education Association and a member of the working group, said that more than 930 schools are at some level of disrepair or in need of HVAC upgrades. That's a huge number and a real undertaking that needs to be taken seriously. What we've been talking about is nothing short of a silent crisis that's affecting our schools. Thankfully, it's finally getting the attention it deserves. In 2022, Governor Ned Lamont signed legislation creating the $244 million grant program. Kushner said that the pending legislation includes provisions that school districts address the air quality of at least 20% of their buildings each year over every 5-year period, spreading out the costs. Make no mistake, this is a socioeconomic issue, said Kate Diaz, a high school math teacher and president of the Connecticut Education Association Teachers Union. When you look at the landscape of who's suffering the most, it's not going to surprise you. She recalled that at the height of the COVID pandemic, the best that administrators could say about air quality was to open the windows of their classrooms and hope for the best. She recalled teachers and kids wearing coats and mittens as snow drifted in from the open windows. Last year, after Hearst Connecticut Media reported that 80 out of 130 schools were denied HVAC grants, lawmakers called for an accelerated grant process. Joanne Amato, a West Haven High School math teacher with 14 years' experience, who is also a member of the 2-year-old school indoor air working group, said that she was first involved in building health issues when, early in her career, she taught in a building constructed in the 1960s. It had leaks, moisture problems, and neither air conditioning nor temperature controls. She was eventually diagnosed with sinus infections and hives, then decided to raise public awareness. Children are uniquely susceptible to health risks from their exposure due to their small size, rapidly growing bodies, and developing main body systems, she said, stressing the need to access information through the Federal Environmental Protection Agency website. In addition, school staff are disproportionately at risk because of the extended periods of time they spend working in these buildings, particularly after 10 years. Amato noted that sick building syndrome is when occupants of a building experience acute health effects linked directly to the time spent in a particular building. Effects of neurotoxins can linger, and prolonged exposure to building long-related illness can be debilitating and life-threatening, she said. Elsewhere on today's front page, 48 hours. Bloody shirt had impact on juror in Michelle Tracona's trial. This article by Liz Hardaway. The latest episode of 48 Hours on CBS explored one of the most awaited criminal proceedings in Connecticut, the trial against Michelle Tracona. A jury found Trakonis guilty on March 1st in connection with the May 2019 death and disappearance of Jennifer Doulos, New Canaan mother of five. Trakonis faces up to 50 years in prison and is scheduled to be sentenced on May 31st. Before the sentencing, there will be a hearing in Trakonis' case on Wednesday in State Superior Court in Stamford, where a judge will hear arguments on motions filed by her attorney requesting acquittal and a new trial. The 42-minute 48 Hours special aired Saturday night, showing evidence presented at the trial, footage from the proceedings, and interviews with people involved in the case. Aaron Moriarty, a correspondent with 48 Hours, interviewed investigators, Trakonis' attorney, her sister Claudia, and an alternate juror. The alternate juror, Patrick, told 48 Hours that closing arguments were where it all came together for him. He asked 48 Hours to use only his first name. "That's when it all made sense to me," he said, "and really up to that point, I had entertained both sides in my head." In Patrick's mind, he said, he debated whether there was an innocent explanation. "Because you want to get it right. I don't want an innocent person to go to jail," he told 48 Hours. Earlier in the special, Patrick said a blood-stained Vineyard Vines shirt that later tested positive for Jennifer Doulos' DNA really had an impact when it was presented during the trial. As an alternate juror, Patrick was released before deliberations began. The six-person jury deliberated for more than 2 days before returning a verdict. They determined Trakonis was guilty on all six counts. Conspiracy to commit murder, 2 counts of conspiracy to tamper with physical evidence, 2 counts of tampering with physical evidence, and 1 count of second-degree hindering prosecution. Patrick told 48 Hours that he agreed with the verdict. Moriarty asked Trakonis' defense attorney, John Schoenhorn, what felt like to hear the guilty verdict. "Well, I held her arm, and I could just feel the energy leave her body," he said. "Everything was dead silent." The special explored the case from the very beginning, showing body camera footage from police officers searching Jennifer Doulos' home in New Canaan. It also showed footage from Trakonis' 3 police interviews, as well as surveillance footage capturing Fotis Doulos, accompanied by Trakonis, discarding items in trash receptacles along Albany Avenue in Hartford, the evening his estranged wife was reported missing. Some of the trash bags that police later recovered were found to contain Jennifer Doulos' blood and DNA, prosecutors said. Schoenhorn was adamant in the 48-hour special that his client had no idea what was going to happen in New Canaan on May 24, 2019. "Michelle simply didn't know," he told Moriarty. Schoenhorn recalled how Fotis Doulos had lied to Trakonis on multiple occasions and said that his client was another victim of Fotis Doulos. Moriarty spoke to investigators on the case, Connecticut State Police Sergeant Kenneth Ventresca and former State Police Detective John Kimball, both of whom testified for the prosecution. Ventresca recalled how, early in the investigation, Fotis Doulos didn't help in the search for his estranged wife and didn't seem concerned. The case, which will reach its 5-year anniversary next month, captured media attention from around the world. The disappearance also inspired numerous documentaries, a Lifetime movie, and a law that broadened the definition of domestic violence in Connecticut. Tony Aiello, a reporter with CBS News New York, commented on the media attention in the case. "The interest in this story was immediate. It was intense, and it was sustained," he told 48 Hours. Despite the attention and the verdict, Jennifer Doulos' body has never been found. Carrie Luft, a longtime friend of Jennifer Doulos and a spokesperson for the family, told 48 Hours that they are still hoping she is found. "We'd like to find her and bring her home. If that doesn't happen, it doesn't change our love for her, she told Moriarty. "She's in each of our hearts." In local news, South Norwalk Electric and Water seeks a 10% rate hike. This article by Catherine Lutke. South Norwalk Electric and Water is proposing to increase water rates by 10% in order to recover increased operating costs and needed improvements. unprecedented economic conditions that resulted in substantial increases in operating costs, states SNEW in its April report. Between 2014 and 2024, the Consumer Price Index Northeast increased by 27%, while at the same time period, SNEW's water rate increases totaled 12.25%. SNEW needs to increase revenue by 36% in fiscal year 2025 to make necessary investments and not incur significant additional debt, according to SNEW's consultant, Raftellis. SNEW Water Operations is facing significant infrastructure costs due to decades of deferred capital investment, mostly in its water distribution system, but also with obsolete SCADA plant control systems, storage facilities, and a significant cost to comply with new regulatory requirements, such as the revised lead and copper rule, the report states. In order to increase revenue, the Second Taxing District Commission, which oversees SNEW, is recommending a 10% across-the-board rate increase on water sales. The increase would be effective on or around July 1st, the report states. Members of the public were expected to share their opinions on the proposed rate changes during a virtual public meeting on Tuesday at 6 p.m., in order to meet short- and long-term operating and infrastructure needs. SNEW management recommends that a multi-year rate increase and debt plan be adopted based on sound information and financial modeling that meets but does not exceed the minimum amount needed to responsibly fund and maintain SNEW's water infrastructure, operations, and financial targets. SNEW reports that the 10% rate increase would generate $1.19 million in additional revenue per year. Residential homes inside the second taxing district with a 5/8 inch meter and 4,000 gallons of water use per month would pay an additional $4.97 per month, bringing their bill to $31.17 a month. Outside of the district, residential homes with a 5/8 inch meter and 4,000 gallons of water use per month would pay an additional $7.46 a month, bringing their bill to $46.85, according to the report. A 4.75% rate increase was implemented in September 2022, according to the report. In a front page article by Sandra Diamond Fox, "Feeling really encouraged, parents of children with a rare condition push for screening." When Jennifer Hand's son, Charlie, was about a year old, she and her husband, Rick Hand, noticed that he wasn't reaching all of his physical milestones. But it took 2 years before he was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. DMD is a genetic condition that affects mostly young boys. It's marked by the progressive loss of muscle as the body fails to make dystrophin, a muscle-building protein. It also deteriorates the skeletal, cardiac, and pulmonary muscles. State legislators are now supporting a bill which, if passed into law, would require children to get screened for Duchenne at birth. A diagnosis at birth would save parents a lot of time and effort in finding a diagnosis and also help to get their children started on available therapies sooner, said Hant, a Darien resident whose son Charlie is now 6. The problem with this disease is it's so nonspecific at first. You notice things, but they're not picked up right away. And so the diagnosis tends to be later, at age 4 or 5, she said. The earlier you understand this disease, the better equipped you are to make decisions and get them in the best care treatment, and that can make such an enormous impact on their outcomes. The bill, called HB No. 5321, an act requiring newborn screening for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, would require all newborns to be tested for this disorder as part of the newborn screening process approved by the Department of Public Health. The cost for genetic screening would be $8 per infant, according to Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, a nonprofit organization. Hant, along with other parents in the state who have children with Duchenne, are strongly advocating for the bill, which, if approved, would go into effect on July 1st, 2027. Ridgefield resident Chris Curran, whose 13-year-old son Connor has Duchenne, said if Connor had been diagnosed with the condition at birth, he could have started on treatments much earlier than he did. Early intervention is key, Curran said. You want to know because you want to start therapy, and we could have started Connor on a steroid regimen or other drugs. Until relatively recently, children with DMD often did not live much beyond their teen years, but patients now have survived into their 30s, thanks to advances in care, according to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. State Representative Amy Berger-Gervallo of Ridgefield, who is a sponsor of the bill, said early diagnosis of Duchenne is critical for timely initiation of treatment, which aims to improve the quality of life and increase lifespan of patients. She said early diagnosis can also provide opportunities for genetic counseling for families who are affected with the condition. She added many times couples will have a second child without knowing that the Duchenne gene is in their family. Newborn screening would offer families an opportunity to provide early treatment and future counseling for family planning, she said. In other local news, Wilton gets federal funds to replace the bridge. This article by Karen Tensa. A project to replace a bridge that has been closed to traffic for many years has received federal funding, according to First Selectman Tony Boucher. The bridge carries Sugar Hollow Road over the Norwalk River in the Georgetown section of northern Wilton near the Ridgefield border. The federal funds were released under the Federal Local Bridge Program, administered by the State Department of Transportation. Preliminary design work is expected to begin this spring, with construction likely starting in 2028, Boucher said in a statement. The 28-foot-long bridge, which is over 90 years old, was reduced to one-lane traffic in December 2017 after it was found to be deteriorating and in need of repairs by the DOT. The bridge had been rated poor since 2002. An inspection in 2016 found that the bridge's exterior beams were deteriorating, and there were missing sections of the bridge's rebar, which is used to reinforce the bridge. In February 2018, the bridge was closed by the DOT until the needed repairs could be made. The analysis indicated that even with the reduction to one lane, the bridge should be closed for safety, then First Selectwoman Lynn Vanderslice said at the time. According to a DOT database of bridge repair projects, the Sugar Hollow Road Bridge in Wilton is due to receive $480,000 in federal funds this year, $100,000 in 2025, and $2.43 million in 2026. The town will receive at least 80% reimbursement from federal aid for all three phases of the project: design, rights-of-way, and construction, with the remaining funds from the state to cover 100% of the costs associated with the bridge replacement. The total estimated cost of the project is $2.92 million, said Thomas Reese, a civil engineer with the Department of Public Works. The federal aid for the project was authorized under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, which is administered by the Federal Highway Administration and Connecticut Department of Transportation. Local and state policy encourages the release of early information on such projects and encourages residents to raise any concerns with municipal officials early in the planning process, Boucher said. Anybody wanting additional information on the project should contact Reese at the Town Department of Public Works at 203-563-0152 or by email at thomas.reese@wiltonct.org. In business news, more offices sell in an affluent Connecticut town. This article by Alexander Soule. After the sale last year of the historic Westport headquarters for the world's largest hedge fund, two more Westport offices have changed hands a mile apart along Post Road West. Entering March, a Stanford private equity investment firm spent $6.6 million for the office building at 315 Post Road West, with plans to reserve a headquarters suite in the building it is now calling Post West Park. They plan to continue to lease the balance of the building to other commercial tenants. Less than 2 weeks later, a larger office building at 8 Wright Street sold for $34 million, nearly $4 million more than what it fetched 5 years ago prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, despite the changes to previous office norms that has prompted many companies to reduce the amount of space they use. The newly renamed Post West Park is among the more visible office buildings in Westport, with a dark, glassy facade on its nearly 3-acre lot across the street from Birchwood Country Club. The property hit the market last May at about the time American Bailey's CEO had contacted commercial brokerage Choice Peterson for assistance in finding new office space in the Westport area. "All of those years I maintained offices in Stamford," said CEO Doug Bailey, who has lived in Westport since 1985. "I had driven by this building many times and admired it. Never thought I would end up owning it." Making a separate investment in Westport not long after was a Greenwich investor named Jose Gonzalez Navarro, who oversees a limited liability company that spent $34 million for 8 Wright Street, which fronts Post Road West and overlooks the Saugatuck River. That was $4 million more than what the Boston real estate investor Waterway Capital paid for the Wright Street office building 5 years ago. Waterway Capital owns another Westport office building at 450 Post Road East, which it bought in 2021 for $15 million. Of nearly 20 local office markets in Fairfield County and Westchester County, New York, Westport had the fifth lowest vacancy rate in that group, according to Cushman & Wakefield, at 16.5% of available offices. Downtown Greenwich leads the nation with a vacancy rate of less than 7%, with Norwalk having the highest vacancy rate, above 42%. "In Stamford and Norwalk, we see vacancy levels at or near all-time heights," said Scott Peterson, vice president of Choice Peterson. "We had a lot of companies take a look at 315 Post Road West from throughout the state and outside the state." Statewide in Connecticut, just 40 offices were listed for sale on the LoopNet commercial real estate website at 30,000 square feet or larger, including one in Milford that goes to auction in mid-April. Campbell's Soup has yet to state its plans for its historic Pepperidge Farm headquarters just east of Post Road West Park in Norwalk, which is vacating next year. Builder Francis DeLuca developed 315 Post Road West in late 1970s, the heyday of suburban office construction. Brud DeLuca is known best for his work as a construction contractor on Stamford's First Presbyterian Church of Stamford on Bedford Street, known as the Fish Church, for its striking architectural design by Wallace Harrison. 3 years ago, the Fish Church became Connecticut's most recent inclusion as a National Historic Landmark. DeLuca died in April 2022, and his family listing the 315 Post Road West office building for sale last spring. Westport's biggest sale ever remains a 2014 transaction for the Nyla Farms Corporate Center, fronting Interstate 95, that is home to Bridgewater Associates, ranked by Forbes as the largest hedge fund in the world, with more than $124 billion in assets under management. Bridgewater's former Glendenning Place headquarters was sold last year for $10.6 million to an entity whose managing team includes David Waldman, whose Westport projects have included the Bedford Square Retail Center downtown and the new Bankside House condos fronting the Saugatuck River. Finally today in today's Life Tributes, Lester W. Bilyeu, the second of Norwalk, peacefully entered eternal life on Monday, April 1st. Michael Stephen Cardillo, Sr. of Reading, passed away peacefully on April 6th. And Paula Ann Tomasetti, Dominic of Wilton, died on April 5th. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, April 10th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.